The TurboPass USA podcast. Bringing you conversations with industry leaders and influencers.
Welcome back to another episode of the TurboPass USA podcast. I've got a very special guest joining me and Ken here today. And Ken is our co-host for today's episode. Say hello, Ken.
Hello, everybody. This is Ken Jarman. What's up, Marco? I like that cap, buddy.
Thank you, my friend. Can't go wrong with barbecue. We've got a very exciting guest joining us today. And this particular guest is someone that's extra special to myself and to Ken. Because the thing that Ken and I have in common is that in a different life, the both of us were involved in the consumer credit space. I mean, we spent quite a bit of time diving in deep into all the little intricacies of the consumer credit world. But there was an individual that the both of us would turn to for knowledge. And in particular, it had a lot to do with the fact that everywhere we went, it seemed like the information that we found was wrong. There was so much, there was just an unbelievable amount of misinformation out there in the consumer credit space. But there was one, it seemed like many times, one lone voice that was very clear and very direct and very accurate about the information he shared, and that is our guest today. Joining us is Mr. John Olzheimer. John is a nationally recognized credit expert, a four times over book author on the subject of credit. And he is the president of the Olzheimer Group and founder of creditexpertwitness.com, as well as probably the only credit expert who actually comes from the credit industry. John spent some time at FICO and some time at Equifax. He also worked at credit.com, and he's got a gazillion articles that he's written or been quoted in over the last, for sure, at least the last decade or so. John, very happy to have you here today. Welcome to the show.
Margaret, thank you for having me, Ken. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the kind words. Not much has changed. There's still a whole lot of junk out there floating around on the internet about consumer credit, but I do my best to kind of play whack-a-mole where I can to try to straighten out some of the stuff that gets thrown around irresponsibly out there. But I appreciate the kind invitation. I'm looking forward to our time today.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're really excited about this, you know, and to your point that you just mentioned, I recently started following you on TikTok. And TikTok has become one of those places where you're either a young kid jumping around and making a fool out of yourself, or you're an adult who's on there looking for information and hacks and tips and things, right? And so I found a lot of people that were talking about credit on TikTok who were supposed to be some type of expert. And of course, because I have a background in this space and because I've been following you and learning from you for so long, I was able to identify that the majority of the information that they were spitting was absolutely wrong. And so it was really nice to see that you joined TikTok of all places to help drop in some accurate information in a place, a cesspool, so to speak, of wrong info. So for those that don't know about you, I gave a little bit of an intro. I talked a little bit about your background, but can you share with us a little bit about how you became an expert on credit as well as a expert witness as well in the credit world?
Yeah, and to tie a bow on the TikTok thing, I went unwillingly screaming and kicking into TikTok. I actually had a 24-year-old convince me that I had to be on TikTok, and but you're right. It was, if I tried to do half the stuff that some of these people on TikTok do, I would pull muscles and tear up my knees. And so I try to keep my I've always seated when I'm talking, if you've ever noticed that. Yeah, so this is, in November, it'll be my 32nd year. So, you know, it's where I'm working into my 32nd year this year. It's consumer credit is the only industry where I've ever worked post-college. And, you know, I've held a variety of positions. They all had something to do with credit. My first job out of college was Equifax, which is obviously one of the three generally recognized credit reporting agencies in the U.S. and one of the two up in Canada. Learned a whole lot about credit reporting, obviously, when I worked at Equifax. I left Equifax to go to FICO, which at the time was called Fair Isaac and Company. Now it's the Fair Isaac Corporation. They're widely regarded with inventing credit scoring. And so I was with FICO for 7 years, and I was immersed into all things having to do with credit scoring, you know, the design and development of the algorithms, which most people don't care or know anything about, to the implementation of scoring systems into underwriting processes, which, again, a lot of consumers don't know or care about. But maybe most importantly is the attributes from credit reports that are considered by credit scoring systems and why they're considered and the weight given to those types of things, which most consumers care a whole lot about. After I left FICO, I went out on my own. I guess lawyers call it hanging out their own shingle. So I hung out my own shingle and began to go to work for a variety of different entities as either a W-2 or concurrently a 1099 contractor. And so I did work for credit.com. I did work for Credit Sesame. I did work for Smart Credit. I was a contractor at Vantage Score Solutions, which is the second most commonly used scoring platform in the U.S. market. I was a contractor there for 8 years, and I've done work concurrently for pretty much every credit bureau, pretty much every debt collector, pretty much every large bank and credit card issuer that you can think of as either an expert witness or as a consultant. So I often refer to myself as kind of an indentured servant to the credit world because it's really all I know. I don't really know anything other than credit reporting, credit scoring, and anything that's kind of wrapped around those two topics. And I spend the majority of my work or time anyways, either writing about credit. And I guess, you know, one of the interesting things that I have to now include, Marco, is I have to now verify or validate that everything that I write is actually human generated content. It's not chatbot or ChatGPT or Google Bard type of, you know, machine created content. It's actually John Olsheimer original, or I do videos for some clients, or I'm doing some sort of expert witness engagement for clients. And so I'm still completely immersed in the credit industry. Just instead of working for big companies, now I'm just doing it on my own.
Very cool, man. Great information and quite the background. Like I said, so 30 plus years, John, you've seen a lot. You've been in different angles of the credit world. How have you seen the credit industry change over the years? And what kind of trends are you currently seeing?
Well, we used to have Equifax TransUnion and TRW, and then we have Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. So I got to see the transition from one company away from credit reporting and then the entrance of a company into credit reporting. So that was certainly a big deal. I've got to see really the implementation of credit scoring into the mortgage environment, which is actually one of the reasons why FICO hired me, was to help kind of support the implementation of FICO scoring into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's automated underwriting systems. So I got to see that happen, which was very cool. I got to see the credit report and the credit score go from being a business-facing product to now a consumer-facing product. So things like credit monitoring systems, you can buy your credit reports, you can buy credit scores, you can subscribe to credit monitoring services. Obviously, that has evolved over time and has kind of morphed as the Fair Credit Reporting Act has been amended, and COVID obviously had a pretty large influence on the credit bureau's decisions to open up free credit reports for everybody pretty much whenever they wanted. And these days now there are so many places to get free credit scores that there's really no point in buying these things any longer unless you're just not shopping around. So the evolution has it continues, right? So this year we had a massive change to how the credit bureaus reported things like medical collections and how VantageScore Solutions considered medical collections. Well, 10 years ago, you know, they were considered and reported just like any other type of collection. So, you know, it's an interesting evolution. And I used to always tell people that something exciting happening in the world of credit was really, really uncommon, right? You'd go years without something really interesting, meaningful enough to write about or meaningful enough that reporters are calling you and want to talk about it. Now it seems to happen with regularity, whether it's a policy that's changed or an amendment to the FCRA or the CARES Act. The CARES Act, which is like 870 pages, actually amended the Fair Credit Reporting Act temporarily and restricted how certain things could be reported. So, you know, it's a dynamic environment now because things are changing almost constantly, and there's things changing on the horizon. This is what's happening in 12 months. This is what's happening in 24 months. Where in the past, it was kind of a sleepy old industry, but certainly not any longer.
Definitely, definitely. One of my favorite subjects that I like to, you know, look to you towards and to get some clarity on is that big one, which is misconceptions. There have always been misconceptions about different things as it relates to credit, right? Or credit scoring. Are they still the same, John? Have they changed in recent years? And do you kind of have a list of maybe your top three or your top five that stand out? And if you would, maybe you can kind of share a few of those with us.
Yeah, you know, the myths, I got to tell you, they're hard to kill because, like, you know, whack-a-mole, you try to eliminate one myth and then, you know, another one pops up somewhere else, and then a couple of years go by and that the myth seems to kind of reappear and someone breathes life into it. Either some journalist or reporter gets it wrong in an article, and then boom, all of a sudden it's like a zombie. It's been, you know, it's almost been, you know, exhumed from the grave, and now it's out there existing. And you know, for all the benefits of things like social media, that also helps to spread the myths, because you're right. I mean, anybody can go on social media and record a 20-minute video and spout off stuff about credit, and there's no credit police that's going to chase them down to make sure they got it all right. But someone watching it may think it's an authoritative source of information and may believe it. And then boom, you have now either a new myth to deal with, or you have a myth that has been, you know, kind of re-upped, if you will. I can tell you this. If you're getting advice from some guy standing in front of a car that he doesn't own, parked in front of a house where he doesn't live, and if that's where you're getting your credit advice, I would suggest get your credit advice elsewhere and maybe do some due diligence to verify that what you're hearing is correct. That always cracks me up. The guy standing in front of a Lamborghini in front of a mansion that where he doesn't live is somehow like the authoritative source of right. credit information. So I think, you know, the one of the myths that has really never gone away, and it probably won't ever go away, is that credit reports and credit scores are the same thing. And the two terms are used interchangeably so often that this one is probably kind of an innocent myth, right? So people will talk about, oh, you know, there's errors on my credit score, or my, you know, I wish my credit report was higher. So I get it. People kind of use the two phrases as if they're the same thing, but they're not. Even the law defines the two things separately. So the law doesn't even recognize them as being the same thing. You have certain rights with respect to credit reports that you don't have with respect to credit scores. You have certain rights with respect to credit scores that you don't have with respect to credit reports. So that's probably one of the most common myths, is that people thinking that these two things are actually the same thing and don't understand that a credit score is kind of like, to use a car metaphor, it's kind of like the leather interior of a car. It's an option that you pay more to have with your car, and you're going to pay more for it when you finish picking up your car at the dealership. So think of a credit score as kind of the leather interior of a credit report. It's something additional that the lender has asked to be included with the credit report and is willing to pay a little bit more for. But you can certainly get a credit report without a score if the lender chooses to do so.
Sure. My co-partner in crime over here, Ken Jarman, has a very extensive background, as you know, John, in the auto world, and spent quite a bit of time at the auto dealership, and he even had his own auto dealership for a period of time. So, Ken, I want to call on you, buddy.
Yep.
What's going on in that big brain of yours over there? And do you have a question for John as it relates maybe to the auto industry?
Yeah, I'm really... Well, I have some questions that popped up about credit. You know, I'm curious. I'm fascinated by the whole FICO introduction that, you know, that you were kind of there for that, because yeah, that was truly transformative. I mean, I worked at my dad's dealership in the 80s and there was no score, and you just looked at the content and the attributes and made decisions. And then FICO got introduced and yeah, it changed, rocked everybody's world. And I'm wondering if you're seeing any, I know there are these revelations that are happening that you're saying, but are there any that are that monumental, or, you know, what are the ones of note that come to, that remind you of that time, or, you know, are there things that you see that are, you know, similar to that, that's changing in credit?
Yeah, I think there's two things. And it's interesting that you bring that up. I've made a lot of presentations in front of a lot of groups. Let's just put it that way. And I'll skip the numbers, but let's just assume that it's a lot. And I always found the auto events, I was not always the least popular guy in the room, because I think they recognized that, I mean, think of it as a finance and insurance manager, as the F&I person. I mean, think of having to consider a credit report that's that thick, you know, 20 or 30 pages, and trying to make a consistent decision about that. And I know how busy F&I people are. I mean, I've got a buddy who was an F&I guy, and he was like, I got to be working at 4 a.m. tomorrow. I mean, they're slammed. But it's a whole lot easier to build a policy around a number, right? Anything above this number is a yes. Anything below this number is a no. Here's a table and a two-dimensional grid. And if you put this map down, blah, blah, blah. If it's this make, this model, and if your credit score is here, you get this. It's just so much easier to build a policy around a three-digit number than it is to try to absorb and then consistently interpret credit report data, because what we think is important as human beings may not necessarily be important empirically, and what we think is not important as human beings may be extremely important empirically. So that's the value, right? So whenever people talk about how horrible the credit reporting and scoring environment is, it's like, you know what? Let me remind you about how when interest rates on mortgages were 19%, it took 9 months to get approved. And then fast forward to today, where you can get pre-approved in about 30 minutes because of your credit score. So, I mean, it's definitely transformed all industries, including auto, including mortgage, including credit card. Instant credit did not exist before credit score, right? Well, we've become so used to being able to apply for stuff on the internet in our underwear at 2 a.m. and being approved within a few minutes, that we've almost become a little bit jaded as to how different it was, quote unquote, back in the day when it was really much more manual and paper-based. I think there are two, Ken, to answer your question, I think there are two things that are happening that are really, really meaningful. Number one is the move, and this is really more mortgage-related than it is auto-related, the move from legacy credit scoring systems to the most contemporary version of FICO and VantageScore's credit scores that Fannie and Freddie are going to start using. And this is probably, they don't give you an exact date ever, but it's looking like in the next 12 to 18 months, give or take. Now, why is this important? It's important primarily for one reason, and I'm going to use my old Ford Explorer as an example. The credit scores that are being, and this is not a criticism of the credit bureaus, this is not a criticism of FICO, they had nothing to do with this, right? In the world of mortgage lending, you have the FHFA, which kind of runs the show. So they're the ones that kind of dictate downward how things have to work, because they're the ones that are essentially buying loans at closing if they meet certain qualifications, and so they get to set the qualifications. That the scores that are being used right now in mortgage lending are the same as my 2001 Ford Explorer. It still works. It's got a lot of miles. It's definitely not as good as something much newer, but it still works, okay? The scores that are going to be used are the 2023 F-150 Lightning. I mean, it is the top dog. It's next to impossible to get because it's in such demand. It's so much better than the same essential truck from 20 years prior, and it's going to do a much better job of assessing the risk of a consumer. That's a big deal, because since we've known each other, This has not happened. There has not been a synchronous change in the credit scoring system that's used in the mortgage lending for over two decades. It's happening now in the next 12 to 18 months, and it's going to be a real big deal. And it's going to be better for consumers because the newer scoring models are better. They're more forgiving. They don't care as much about certain things that the older models care much more about. And so it's going to be a win for consumers. That's number one. Number two, and this is actually, for me, is troubling, right? The conversion to the newer models is fantastic. It's a double thumbs up. This next one to me is very troubling. And that is the continued dilution of information off of credit reports. Okay. Let me give you a few examples of what I call kind of the graveyard or the cemetery of credit report information. So rest in peace, tax liens. Rest in peace, civil judgments. Rest in peace, medical collections that have it. So here are things that 5 years ago are all over credit reports, and no one ever had a complaint about the fact that judgments and tax liens and medical collections were on credit reports. It's because people knew that they were the result of either people messing up with an obligation, or they unfortunately had a medical event that was not covered by insurance and they couldn't pay it out of pocket. And doctors want to get paid just like auto lenders want to get paid and how credit card issuers want to get paid. So they outsource it to collections, debt collectors and whatnot, and they end up on credit reports. Those types of things today, they really don't exist. And especially for the public records, but for medical collections, unless they need a very, very narrow slice, so they have to be really large dollar and they really have to be over a year old before they can possibly end up on a credit report. And if they eventually are paid, then they're coming off of a credit report. So it's the dilution of information which troubles me. And the reason it troubles me is because it doesn't help people. Most people in this country have good credit. The average FICO score is 716. Most people think it's much lower than that. But the average FICO score can get you a pretty darn good deal on an auto loan, right? 716 is a pretty good score if you're out there looking for a car. And I think most people would acknowledge that 716 is a respectable score. Well, that's the average score, which means you have people who score considerably higher. They don't care about things like civil judgments and tax liens and medical collections because they don't have any of that stuff. They never had any of that stuff because they had really good credit. But when you're diluting a credit report of information that is predictive, no one ever argues that this stuff is not predictive. It wouldn't be considered in scoring systems in the first place if it wasn't predictive. It's always been predictive, even though people want to try to suggest and pretend like it's no big deal. If it was no big deal, it would have never been included in the first place, right? So all this stuff is now off of consumer credit reports, which means that the credit scoring systems have to work harder, which is fine, but now they have to consider other things that they maybe didn't consider in the past. So you may be robbing Peter to pay Paul because you're taking things off of credit reports that, other than the medical collections, probably should still be there, right? If I'm not paying my tax obligations or if I have a judgment obligation, I think it's fair that a lender knows these things because it's important to them to make a decision. I'd want to know it if I was lending money to somebody. I'd want to know it if I was going to lease out a home or rent an apartment to somebody. I think it's a fair and reasonable thing. And certainly, I can go find those things. They're public records. And LexisNexis sells a report with that information. But I've got to go look for it now. It's not on a consumer credit report anymore, any longer. And Ken, who knows, in 12 or 24 or 36 months, what's the next thing on the chopping block that we're talking about? If some people had their way, the statute of limitations for how long bad stuff could remain on a credit report, which we know today is between 7 and 10 years, depending on the item, would go down to 2 years. 2 years. And that's because some other country does it that way, and therefore that justifies why we should do it that way. Can you imagine the amount of fraud that would occur if everyone knew that they only have a 2-year horizon of bad credit reporting? Bankruptcies, judgments, or excuse me, bankruptcies, charge-offs, repos, foreclosures, other collections, 2 years. The amount of fraud, because people would realize, dude, I just have to sort of, you know, deal with it for 2 years and I'll be back in action because all this stuff will be off my credit report. So I don't like that direction. I think more data is good rather than less data. And lenders, even though they're kind of scared to verbalize that right now, I think off the record, they'd probably agree with me. But who knows? Maybe in the next 5 years, we'll see more of this stuff added back to credit reports. But I feel like that stuff is, I think the coffin has been nailed shut, and I think we'll never see that kind of stuff any longer. And that troubles me.
That's awesome. It's a great answer. And now it leads to a bunch of other questions. And
it's like question A, subsection 12.
Well, I love it, man. I've always enjoyed getting education from you, and today is no different. I have a question. You know, hopefully some auto finance guys are listening, F&I guys are listening, people in the auto industry, and you know, they're dealing with consumers every day, obviously talking to them. And you're right. Usually the consumer comes in with their Credit Karma. They already know their score. They're showing it to the salesperson, asking them how they're going to fare in the financing. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for, you know, I guess, well, so if they get approved for an auto loan, is there any strategy to get the most out of that trade line? You know, let's say they get approved for $20,000. It's their first installment loan. What's the best way to get the most out of that trade line?
Yeah, so that's a big deal. For those of you who don't know, Ken's using an industry term, trade line. A trade line is what we in the industry refer to as, it's just an account. So if you have a Nissan Motor Acceptance Corporation loan, we call those trade lines. They're lines of trade that appear on your credit report. That's a big deal. Getting your first installment loan is a big deal because credit scoring system, well, first off, you know, congratulations for getting your first installment loan. They're managed very differently than any other type of account you have. They're usually secured, so you need to make your payments or something's going to come get taken away from you if you don't. But credit scoring systems love to see diversity and management of different types of accounts. And so for someone who, let's say, just graduated from college and all they have is a bunch of deferred student loans, you know, that person is not going to score as well as someone who has an experience managing credit cards and an experience managing actual mature installment loans where there's a current obligation to pay it back and that you have been paying it back. And so there's recent activity that indicates that you are, in fact, able to manage those accounts properly. So that's the benefit number one of the first installment account is that your score, the credit scoring systems are going to reward you because of it. That's number one. Number two is, and this, Marco, you can throw this on your list of myths if you want. There's a really rotten and stubborn myth about the influence of installment debt on credit scores. It's no secret that debt is considered in credit scoring systems. There are three types of debt. People just kind of forget about that they just kind of glom all debt together as if debt is debt. And that comes from what I call kind of a fake personal finance experts on TV that sell things. They talk about how all debt's bad and debt's evil and you shouldn't have any debt. And if you want to buy something, save money for 15 years so you can pay cash for it, which is stupid, but we'll move on. All debt is not the same. And I'm not talking about, you know, how student loan debt is good because you have a degree and you're going to earn. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the influence on your credit scores, which has nothing to do with the practical impact of having a college degree versus a home loan or versus a car. I'm talking about the connection between the debt and credit risk. And again, this is all something that's determined by companies like FICO and the credit bureaus and the folks who build their own credit scoring systems is what is that relationship, right? That's the reason everything counts on a credit report to a credit score. So whenever you hear about, well, why do inquiries count? Why does debt count? Why do late payments count? It's because there's a relationship between the event and risk. And some things are highly predictive of elevated credit risk, like charge-offs. And some things are almost immaterial, but yet just barely important enough to be on the radar. Things like inquiries, okay? And then everything else kind of falls between payment history issues and whether or not you have inquiries on your credit report. debt is one of those things. Debt falls kind of in between on the meter, if you will, of influence and importance in credit scoring systems. So there's three types of debts that show up on credit reports. Installment debt, so like your auto loan. Revolving debt, like your credit card. And open debt. And now when I say open, I don't mean the opposite of closed. I mean open debt where you have a single payment due upon demand. So things like your American Express green card, right? If you get a bill for $500, you got to pay $500 because you don't have terms. It's one payment for the entire amount. Collections. So if you have collections on your credit report, that's considered open debt. If you have a collection that's a $1,000 collection, you don't have 10 months at $100. You owe them $1,000 in one lump sum. So that's that type of debt. Installment debt is almost immaterial to your credit scores, as long as it's being paid, of course. If it's in default, then that's a completely different set of metrics. But you can have seven figures plus of installment debt and have elite credit scores, well into the 800s. You cannot say the same thing about revolving debt. So if you have a lot of credit card debt, multiple credit cards with balances, credit cards that are maxed out, meaning that the balance is either really close to the limit or at the limit, those are the types of things that are very, very predictive of elevated credit risk, which is why even having modest, what you may think is a modest amount of credit card debt, can be much more problematic than having an $800,000 mortgage and $50,000 of auto loans. The debt is, I mean, the amount of debt is not even close, but one debt is not nearly as predictive of credit risk as the other type of debt, which is why you can have really stratospheric scores, but still having a lot of debt. And there's no shortage of irritated consumer blogs who complained about paying off debt or refinancing debt or consolidating debt, and their credit scores went down. And it's counterintuitive because they believe that if you pay off debt, your credit score should go up rather than go down. But if you have no installment debt because you've paid off all of your installment loans, then it's very possible that your scores are actually going to go down instead of going up. And the reason they're going to go down is because, again, credit scoring systems love to see people managing installment debt properly, so they reward you because of it. If you have paid off all your installment debt, you're not managing it any longer, so they can't reward you for doing it. You're getting tons of points for other things, like not going into default and having old credit reports, but you also do not get to benefit from the fact that you're actively managing, properly managing an installment account. So it's that's another one that's a little bit irritating, is that people tend to throw installment debt around as if it's like this evil debt, when the reality is that it is absolutely not an evil type of debt. So that's the benefit of being in the auto business, is the type of debt that ends up on a credit report because of the F&I person is actually a helpful debt, you know, notwithstanding the fact that you can now get around because you have a car, but also because it's very, very likely to be beneficial to you from a credit perspective.
That's awesome. Well, John's dropping some big golden nuggets for us.
So what up? You disappeared, oh. Marco.
I don't know. I still see myself. Do you see me, John? I still see myself. There we go. How are you doing on time, John?
Oh, wow.
I think we're at 35 right now, right?
Fine,
I have a little clock on.
Yeah, you still got a few more minutes to talk with us?
Let's do it.
Okay, excellent. We will start the process of wrapping things up, but I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about your expert witness stuff. You've definitely, without a doubt, you've created a name for yourself in that space, and I know that you are even teaching others on how to do something similar and follow suit. Tell us a little bit about some of the cases, or, you know, not necessarily the, you know, you can omit any details that you want to omit, but, you know, just a little bit about what you're doing and kind of how that works for someone that doesn't have a clue about what, you know, expert witness is. You know, shed some light on that for us, if you will.
Yeah, well, this is one of those things in life where, and I'm sure both of you have, as you're contemplating your existence and thinking back about how, you know, if you would have taken a left here versus a right, your life would have ended up completely, you know, everyone has those kind of reminiscing. I was actually talking about that with my son the other day. If I would have not, if I would have not tracked down my wife at the water fountain, you know, 26 years ago, back before they had, you know, cell phones and all that, and he would not exist. And so his argument was that he would exist, but he would just, you know, be in a different body. But
let's see.
So this, my story is actually, is that story, right? I think we all have a similar path where if you would have taken one step versus the other, things could have been very, very different. So mine, when I left, so I had my time at Equifax. I had my time at FICO. I left FICO to do my own thing. And within a year after leaving, I got a phone call from a lawyer in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is the home of maybe some of the best food in the country. If you've never been there, you're missing something. And he was referred to me by an Equifax system affiliate. So Equifax, it's all the credit bureaus of one time or another. They didn't own all the credit reports across the U.S. They had partnerships with smaller local credit bureaus that owned the data in certain small geographies of the country. And so they had affiliate relationships. Baton Rouge was one of them. So you have the Credit Bureau of Baton Rouge. Doesn't exist any longer. But at one time, they owned all the credit reports on the Equifax system, was this company, Credit Bureau of Baton Rouge. Well, they were getting sued because of how a credit card was appearing on one of their credit reports. And the plaintiff had an expert witness who had given opinions about how damaging and harmful this thing was to the plaintiff's credit scores. And the defendant wanted someone to come in and offer rebuttal opinions about the effect of this credit card on credit scores. And so they reached out to me and asked me if I'd be interested. And my response was, what? What does that mean? What is an expert witness? I don't understand. Do I get paid for that? How do I get paid? And it was almost like the lawyer was like, oh my God. Okay. Expert witness 101. So he kind of explained, this is what an expert witness does. This is the process. Yes, you get paid. Here's kind of how much they get paid. And yeah, you probably need a contract. So I did my first case and I wrote a report. I was deposed, which means I actually got to testify, which is, you know, a stressful thing if you've never done it before. And I got paid and I thought, wow, this is fun. Onesie and twosie. I can check that off my list and move on. The following year, I got a phone call from she was FICO's former assistant general counsel. She was the number two attorney at the company who had left and was in-house counsel at a mortgage servicer. They were getting sued for the same thing, except for it was their mortgage account that was on someone's credit report. So they needed an expert, and they asked if I was interested. And so that was it, Marco. That was the fork in the road. When that happened, it went from being an anomaly to a pattern. And then I realized, wait a minute, there may be more here than what I have experienced. So I did that case. Everything worked out fine. No big deal. And then I got to work. I snapped up like 150 domains. Let's just say that the people in my small world of credit expert witnesses do not understand search engine optimization, which is fantastic. So all these domains were still available. So I got them in retail. I hired a webmaster. He built, I don't even know how many websites. God's honest truth, I have no idea how many websites I have. I could have a dozen. I could have 100. I don't know. So he built tons and tons of websites, optimized them for different terms that lawyers would search on to find people like me. And it went from one or two cases and it blew up. And for the last either 11 or 12 years, in the middle of a global pandemic, mind you, the number of Fair Credit Reporting Act, and in my world, that's the primary federal statute, is the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The number of Fair Credit Reporting Act lawsuits year over year for the last 11 or 12 years has set a record for the number of lawsuits filed. So the trajectory of those lawsuits is like this, which means that it's a nonstop train of requests for an expert witness. There are about, I don't know, maybe four or five people that do this work as a plaintiff's expert. There's one that does it primarily on the defense side, and you're looking at them. So I would love to clone myself two or three times over, because I wouldn't have to turn down as much business as I turn down, because I just simply don't have the bandwidth to take on new work. And so what does that mean to be an expert? Well, it's one of the few things in my world that actually means what it sounds like. You have to have specialized knowledge in a subject to be able to testify in front of a jury as an expert. And the judge or the court is the gatekeeper. So if the judge doesn't think you're an expert, you can call yourself an expert all day long. But if the judge doesn't think you have the appropriate expertise, he or she's not going to let you sit in front of a jury and spout off on something that they're not confident that you know what you're talking about. And there are some people in my world who try to get away with that, and they get there's a procedure where you can be challenged. And a lot of times these guys and gals, they try to be the expert of everything and try to, what I call going outside your sandbox. And they kind of get slapped back into their lane. So that's really the job of an expert, is to offer expert opinions, and on, you know, based on document review, transcripts of depositions, and in some scenarios you have to go through the deposition process, meaning that the other attorney gets to depose you and find out what your opinions are, the basis of your opinions, how you would answer certain things at a trial, and then on a much more infrequent basis, you may actually have to travel somewhere and testify in front of a jury, like you see on TV, people testifying in front of juries. So that takes up the, you know, probably 75% of my time is doing work as an expert. And it's, you know, knock on wood, the trajectory right now is just busier and busier and busier, which is unfortunate, because I can't. There's only 24 hours in a day, and you know, your work-life balance gets all out of whack if you don't know how to say no. And so I need to do a better job of trying to control that.
Well, the good news is, John, is that here in the next year or two, the AI will probably allow you to duplicate yourself. So just hold on tight, and you'll be doing two or three of these things at once.
I actually, it's interesting you say that. I was thinking about that last night. 60 Minutes, or is there 60 Minutes or 2020? No, 60 Minutes had a segment about Google Bard, which is their AI. And I, you know, it looks like being an author is kind of you're about to become an endangered species. If you're an author, then you are entirely replaceable by AI. And I don't know that would ever bleed over into the world of an expert witness, because if a judge asks you, or if you're asked at a deposition, did you write this report that has your name at the end of it? And if you say, first off, you have to be honest, because lying under oath is a felony. It's called perjury. So you have to be honest. So that's number one. Number two is if you say, no, I had ChatGPT write most of my report for me, you're done. You're dead meat, because the word is going to get out that you don't do your own work, you depend on AI. And it's not really your opinion, it's some machine's opinion, and you're done in the industry. So I while it may eliminate my content work, my blogging, for a cheaper alternative, I'm okay with that, because if people would rather pay, you know, Fiverr did a number. I don't know if y'all know what Fiverr is, or you can pay someone $5 to do anything. So Fiverr did a pretty good number on the blogosphere, where you could pay someone almost nothing to rip off someone's article and use a synonym generator and change some of the words. But certainly AI is going to eliminate a lot of the people who write, but I don't know that it's going to eliminate people who write really specialized stuff like what I do.
Sure. John, I've got two final questions for you, and these are a very different direction as we wrap up our conversation. Something that I don't hear you talk about as often is what John Alzheimer does when he's not completely enamored with credit related matters, right? Yeah. So the first question is, you were mentioning earlier about kind of trying to find that work life balance. You've got an overwhelming amount of these cases going, but you know, you can't bilocate, unfortunately. So there's only so much you can do. But what do you enjoy doing when you do have some downtime? I know you do have a little bit of a love for probably loud vehicles that that machines that go quickly. That may or may not be one of them. But what do you do in your free time when you're not working? And then I've got one follow-up question to that afterward.
Sure. So I've gotten to the age now where I have an unbelievable appreciation for family and friends, because at my age now, I'm starting to lose family and friends, right? I've lost family and friends to COVID, lost family and friends to, you know, cancer, actually, if you could see his picture right back there, one of the guys in that picture, one of my best friends, lost him to cancer a couple of years ago. So I have a different type of appreciation for family and friends now because I'm starting to lose some of them. So I love spending time with family and friends. And it doesn't even have to be doing something fun. It can be sitting around drinking cheap beer. I don't care. I have a weird off the chart appreciation for that. But you're right. I also run a lot. I run 600 miles a year is my target, which is 2 10Ks a week in order to be able to hit that. But so every year I run 600 miles. And I do that because I like to eat whatever the hell I want to eat, and I don't want to be on a diet, so I'd rather just outrun my diet. That's why I run as much as I do. But I absolutely love muscle cars, not the old stuff, the more contemporary muscle cars. So I've got a Shelby, a GT500 in the garage, which, you know, I've got to be super careful with because, A, it's way too powerful, 760 horsepower, which is 400 more horsepower than anybody really needs. And around here, if you get caught going too fast, you end up in the slammer because we got a bad street racing problem here in Atlanta. So it's that kind of stuff. Family and friends. I try to stay in good shape because I don't want to be one of those guys who checks out early because he doesn't take care of himself. And then I absolutely love going fast, especially around corners.
I got you. I appreciate that. And I think many of us can certainly relate to your of a enlightenment to just making sure that, you know, it doesn't even have to be quality time. It could be quantity time with people not doing anything in particularly special, just hanging out. So I really appreciate you sharing that. The last question, John, what's something that people may be surprised to know about John Olzheimer? Do you have a hidden talent or skill or maybe unique or interesting life experience that you could share?
I do. This is one of those really good questions of the day. You know, tell us something about you that nobody knows. So, you know, I grew up in Atlanta. For those of you who don't know, I grew up in Atlanta. And there's two colleges here that are kind of the primary colleges, Georgia and Georgia Tech. So if you follow college sports, you know that Georgia Tech, their mascot is the Yellow Jacket, right? And the Yellow Jacket is Buzz. Right. So it's a pretty popular mascot. And you see Buzz around the football stadiums and around the basketball games. And, you know, it's the big outfit looks like a yellow jacket. I did not go to Georgia Tech. They would have appropriately declined my application for admission back when I applied for colleges in the mid-80s because I did not have the academic skills to go to Georgia Tech. But I did have a friend who went to Georgia Tech and he was Buzz. And so during the halftime of a Georgia Tech versus Duke, and this is back when Duke was really, really good, at the halftime of a Duke-Georgia Tech basketball game, we snuck into the bowels of back, it was called the Thriller Dome. It may still be called the Thriller Dome, but that's what Georgia Tech calls the place where they play basketball. We snuck into the bowels of the Thriller Dome, and I got into the Buzz outfit. And I went out. I had more access than the president of the United States. I was able to walk out onto the court, and I could do anything I wanted. I was Georgia Tech royalty for about 25, 30 minutes because I was the unauthorized Buzz during that time. And so a couple of things. Number one, that outfit stinks. It absolutely worries. Number two, it's wet because you get sweaty in there, and the sweat is gross. And number three, the way you have to walk in those things is so unusual that you wake up the next day and your back is just, you're really, really sore because you're using muscles that you wouldn't normally use. So that's it. So when I tell people I was Buzz for the basketball game, no one would have ever thought that.
Ken,
that's cool.
We won't be able to see any John the same this point forward. We'll always see him.
Right. I got to look that thing up now. That is awesome.
I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today out of your busy schedule and dropping all kinds of wisdom on us. And most importantly, accurate wisdom. That's what we're looking for. We want accurate information. And so we thank you for always being a resource of accurate information over the years for us in an industry and a space where it's unfortunately hard to find that. So thank you for stepping out and sharing your, you know, all your talent with the whole world, because with all those articles that are out there, I think, you know, you're very much a celebrity in the credit space, but to the average consumer, they've probably read your article. They just didn't know who you were, or at least, you know, something that you quoted, you know, and I think a lot of people probably benefited from your information. And I know I personally enjoyed seeing that handsome face of yours in front of Larry King for many 1 o'clock in the morning weeknights throughout the last several years.
So, that's right. And another cool. If you acknowledge that you saw that infomercial, then that means that you were watching the Cooking Channel at 3 a.m. because that's usually when they run those types of things, and it's put down on the TV channel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that was exactly what I was doing, as a matter of fact. So thank you for dropping all of that info. And again, we can't thank you enough for being a visitor on our Turbo Pass USA podcast today.
Hey, my pleasure. Let's do it again, Jen. Have a good one.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Not good. And that does it, guys, for another episode of the Turbo Pass USA podcast. We will catch you here next time.
Thank you for listening to the Turbo Pass USA podcast. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show or to listen to past episodes, please visit turbopassusa.com/podcast.